Johnson. So we're gonna pray and get started. Will you bow with me, please? Our Father in heaven, we thank you for allowing us to wake up and see this day, allowing us to make it to this point in the day and giving us the privilege of opening your word and studying it together. We do hope and pray that you'll help us as we look into your word to come away with a better understanding than we went in, to have a heart and a mind steadfast in application. Help us to be an encouragement and a help to one another as we undertake this joint endeavor. We love you and thank you for the many ways in which you richly bless us. We ask these things and offer our thanks in the name of Christ. Amen. Okay, how has your week been? It's not rhetorical, by the way. We got to get used to each other. How has your week been? Has it been good? Somebody tell me the truth now. Everybody, maybe not, hasn't been good for everybody, but you know, that's why we have an opportunity here in the middle of the week to come together and encourage each other, edify each other, strengthen ourselves so we can finish out strong. You know, we like to begin strong with the Lord's Day, have this fill-up stop in the middle, and then we want to finish strong. So over the course of the next couple, 3 months, we're going to be thinking about the Thessalonian church. I'm imagining that that's not a surprise to you. But before we dig into it, I want to think with you for just a moment about how you study the Bible. When I study the Bible, I like to vary my approach. It keeps it interesting for me. I think it's good to look at things from different perspectives. How do you study the Bible? I'm sure you have some time set aside each day, maybe some more extended times during the week. When you go into the Bible, what's your plan? What's your plan? Okay, I know we have to get used to each other. That's not rhetorical. I know it. It's adjustment time, right? When you read your Bible, how do you go into it? What are you looking for? What do you do? Some people, for example, may just do a verse-by-verse study, right? They go in and they try to pull apart every word of every verse, and that's good. I enjoy doing that. At a certain point, you're going to exhaust yourself doing that. So what else might you do? What else might you do? Say again. Topical studies, okay? There are certain subjects that are important, recurring subjects for those who are trying to live like Christ. Love, for example, would be one of them. You can search the Bible from beginning to end and find information that's relevant to that subject. And it helps you have a more comprehensive view of the subject when you study it topically, right? What else? Yes, sir.
I try to look at the historical and geographical setting and put myself in.
Okay, you and I, then we have a similar mind. It says he likes to look at the historical and geographical setting to put himself into the time that he's reading and studying about. And I think that's helpful. That's what we're going to do today as we begin to orient ourselves to look at the Church of the Thessalonians. By the way, I'm not all that imaginative. I use that title because that's the way Paul began his two letters. Paul, Silas, and Timothy to the Church of the Thessalonians. That's the way he began the letter, so that's what we call the series of studies. So what else? Historical and geographical? Yes, ma'am. Okay. Okay, so we may have sort of a study or a devotional that's prepared for us. We read that, and along with that, we read the scriptures that are relevant. I'm sure some of you have done... character studies, right? You look at the life of a man like David or Noah, or you look at people who've done well and people who haven't done so well, right? That's what we're doing in our Sunday morning class in our study of the Kings. These are character studies. What else? I think that may be helpful maybe for somebody, some ideas to freshen up your study. What else? Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Chronological study. Boy, isn't that helpful because the Bible's not written chronologically. To try to approach it and read it in a sequential fashion as best you can. You see some things maybe that you wouldn't see otherwise. You go through the Kings and the Chronicles, for example, and you pause and go back and read the prophets at the time of the writing, chronological. You see some things you wouldn't see if you didn't do that. Well, one of the things I like to do, all of those, I enjoy all of that. One of the things I like to do with the New Testament epistles to the churches, I like to, as best I can, study those churches. You know, each of these congregations had certain characteristics They were different. They were born sometimes under different circumstances, and they faced different challenges. They had different strengths and weaknesses. And I think as a congregation, there are many vital lessons to uncover in a study like that. The Thessalonian epistles, they just have always appealed to me for a lot of reasons. I just think they're thrilling to read through them. The church there at Thessalonica was at once an encouraging, inspiring church, but it was a church that had challenges, internal and external. And again, I think there's a lot that we could draw from that. There's some things we could look at that we'd say, boy, if we could just be more like that, that would be great. And there's some things we could look at where we could say, you know what, the same trouble they're having, we've had that before, might have it again. And we can look at the apostle's guidance and his advice. You know, so while we will look at the epistles, we certainly will do that. At certain times, we may sort of jump around within the epistles a little to try to pull together information that Paul is sharing in the two letters that might be relevant to the same subject. We will look outside of the epistles to some extent and degree because we read about the beginning of this church in the book of Acts, and any time Acts records the establishment of a congregation to which Paul would later write, I think it's important to make sure we understand those beginnings, so we'll do that as well. Today, what I want to do is begin setting our minds in the time and place that we read about when we read those epistles. Questions or thoughts? Questions or thoughts? All right. Now, you guys feel free to jump in, ask questions, make comments. Feel free. I lecture all day, right, at the law school, and they don't speak unless I make them. I'm hoping you guys will be more free to share whatever's on your mind. So I choose this sub-theme because this is one of the defining characteristics of this congregation and the letters that Paul writes, looking and living for the Lord's return. Isn't that a good idea? For us to always be looking to the Lord's return and always living our lives today in light of the fact that he will return. Well, this congregation, you might say, was obsessed with that idea. And so that's the reason I choose that sub-theme. As we begin today, I want us to think about the city of Thessalonica. The church did not exist in a vacuum. No church does. This congregation is situated in Montgomery, Alabama. Don't you know that because you're in Montgomery, Alabama, you have some different opportunities, some different challenges, and that there are some different, there's a different culture maybe than you might have in Washington, D.C., where I came from? You know that, right? And so it's important to think about the city in which this congregation was situated, and that's why I want to begin thinking together about the city of Thessalonica. It is my opinion that you will better understand what you read when you read about the establishment of this church and when you read the epistles that Paul wrote to this church, when you understand some things about where the church existed. So, the location of the church, the history of the city in which it was located, some things about the politics, some things about the religious climate, some important historical aspects of what was going on in that place. This kind of background helps you to make better sense of what you read when you read these precious few verses that we have in the Bible regarding this particular congregation. So we'll consider some of the background information, historical, geographical, and otherwise. It's really just to wet our palates. You guys are familiar with that, to prepare you for the meal that we're going to be consuming, to really prepare our minds to dive in. As best we can, we want to take ourselves back to the time and place that we're reading about. So let's take a look here. Here we are. Let's see here. I don't know, you can't see that because you can see maybe a little, right? This is close to where we are. That's supposed to be Alabama. And you can see that in order for us to study the church at Thessalonica, we have to go all the way, well, I say halfway, across the globe here to a different region of the world. And, of course, we are living some 2,000 years after they did, so we can't sort of apply some of our modern conventions and so forth in the United States today to these people. We've got to, as best we can, get ourselves set to think about them and where they were. So this is halfway around the world. And there's Thessalonica. Anybody know what country this is? What do we call this country today? Okay, this is Greece. Of course, this is Italy over here. The seat of the Roman Empire is in Rome up this way. So we're not that far away. We're in that part of the world, of course, and a lot of these cities are familiar to you. Of course, the island of Crete, we know that Paul says that he left Titus there at Crete so that he could set things in order. We're familiar with Ephesus. We know that Paul went there and converted some people after Apollos had gone away. We know that he wrote a letter to this congregation and the Lord dictated a letter. We know Troas, the Bible says he spent 7 days there and partook of the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week. We refer to that very often. And here's Philippi. Now, when we get up to Philippi, we're in a region in Greece, the northern part of Greece that we would call Macedonia. And they called it Macedonia, this northern part. But all of this is Greece. So Philippi, Thessalonica, and Berea, of course, we know that after Paul left Thessalonica, he went to Berea. We'll think about that next week. This southern region in Greece is called Achaia. And prominent cities in Achaia include Athens. What happened in Athens? What happened in Athens? The apostle went there, and what did he do there, or where did he do it? He went to the Areopagus, right? Sometimes called Mars Hill. And so these are places familiar to us. This is the part of the world that we're in. Of course, Corinth, we've got a couple of letters there. This is where we are, halfway around the world. Notice any of these geographic features here? Boy, there's an awful lot of this blue stuff, isn't there? A lot of water, a lot of seas. So that's where we're going. Now let's think about the founding of this city. Again, I told you, it's 2,000 years ago that we're primarily interested in, but if we were to back up a few hundred years from that time, then we might run into a person, if we were in that part of the world, named Cassander. Cassander is the person who assumed control of the region of Macedonia after Alexander the Great. Now, who is Alexander the Great? Anybody? He's a great conqueror. Anybody know his dad's name? Philip. It's up there probably, so that's cheating, right? But Philip of Macedon. So these guys were from this part of the world, Macedonia. His dad, Philip, was a king before him. Alexander was a great and mighty conqueror. I mean, he conquered all that stuff that we were looking at here, all of this and much, much more. He conquered all of this. In 315, the king who ruled after him was Cassander, and Cassander established this city. It's my habit to say Thessalonica. It seems like when you think about it as somebody's name, Thessalonica would make more sense. But by any, however you want to say it, that was his wife's name, and he named this city after his wife. Okay, so this was an important place to him. His wife happened to be the daughter of Philip, the father of Alexander, and his wife happened to be, this is the way they did things back then. His wife happened to be the sister of Alexander, these political marriages that they had. Now, here's something I want you to think about. I showed you the map of all that water there. Why would he establish a city in that place and name that city after his wife? The city had a strategic location right there on the Aegean Sea. Obviously, there would have been a lot of opportunities for commerce as a water thoroughfare there, a seaport. This was a really busy place. And today, it is still a really busy place. I pulled this picture just so you can get an idea of where what we're talking about when I say it's a seaport. So this is the sea right here in front, of course, and you can see how these buildings develop right up on the sea. I mean, they're hard up on the shore, and you can see just how sprawling a city this is today. Now, I know these aren't the structures that would have been there 2,000 years ago, but when I tell you this was the largest city in this part of what is currently Greece 2,000 years ago, and it remains the largest city in this part of Greece today, you can understand that while the structures may have been a little different, we're talking about a significantly urban area. A significantly urban area. Sometimes that's important for me to remind myself, you know, because I think, well, 2,000 years ago, I mean, those guys were living in huts or something, weren't they? I mean, that's just what I sort of see in my mind, that they would have had a much more primitive existence. And indeed, they would have, because they wouldn't have had some of the technology that we have. But listen, this was a chief city. Paul went to, you know, it may not have been New York, but maybe it's Philadelphia. I mean, it's a big city. All right. So the Greeks established the city, but we know that the Romans, at a certain point, overcame the Greeks and subsumed their empire. Now, when they did that, they did not have to reinvent the wheel. We know the Romans subsumed a lot of Greek culture. They just sort of moved in and began to carry on what the Greeks had already done before them. So they conquered Thessalonica in 168 BC, and they made it a capital city. They had these different districts, these different regions, and they made it a capital city there in Macedonia. The Greeks had done that. The Romans did very much the same. So it became a capital city for them and a political center. I think that part's important. You know, you don't think about that right now, but there's something in Acts 17 that makes it relevant that this was a political center. And we'll take a look at that. Now, you see all that water. You see how that big city is right there on the water. The Romans made it a naval station. Big cosmopolitan city with a large military presence. Some of you guys are in the military. Anybody served in the military? What comes along with a city having a large, what branch, by the way? Air Force. What comes along with a city having a military base in it? What comes along with the base being there? Say again? Money comes, okay? Bases just sit empty. Do they run themselves? Probably not, right? People. So we've got an indigenous population that is Greek, Macedonian. The Greeks, the Romans conquer it, but they don't treat it like they might have treated some faraway outpost. They put their naval station there, and with that station, you're going to have a large influx of Romans. Not just any Romans, but Roman military, and with that, all the money and the resources and everything that go along with that. So this was a big city to the Romans as well. The location is important. The water makes it important. Paul got there by water. But that's not the only important feature regarding the location. The Romans built a road that went through Thessalonica called the Via Ignatia, or the Ignatian Way. The Ignatian Way. What the Romans were fantastic road builders. Right? They were fantastic road builders. They had a road that went from the top of the northern part of Italy down to the boot hill called the Appian Way. Now, when you cross the sea and you get over to Greece, you know, this map, if you just permit me, I want to back up and show you something here. Now, if you were coming from Italy and you wanted to get over to this area or beyond it, you see, you've got a couple of options here. You can either go on land, right? Take this short trip across the sea, and I think you got to go that direction, across the sea, and then go across the land, or you can try to do this. That's a kind of long trip, isn't it? And you see all this stuff right here? What's that? It's probably not exciting for a Navy person to see all of that. So the Romans decided to do it this way, and so they built the Ignatian Way. I thought it was interesting. I just show you this. You can find these kinds of remnants of the Ignatian Way. There are lots of these. This is just one. I thought it was a clear one, an easy one that you can see. This is a street sign. So if you go out here and you find one of those, usually they're green signs that says Atlanta Highway, this is the Roman version of that. A little heavier than ours, but got the job done. And you can see it here, Ignatia Hodos. Ignatia Hodos. That's the Greek. So this is the Ignatian Way in Greek. And Via Ignatia, that is in Latin. Those are the prominent languages that would have been spoken in that part of the world. And here it is. So we've got the Appian Way here terminating at the sea in Italy, and then we've got the Ignatian Way, which traverses all the way from the Adriatic over to the Black Sea, all the way across Greece, east to west, west to east. And here's our city. So not only does this city have all of this waterway coming into it, but it also has this fantastic road that, by the way, still exists. I mean, the Romans were fantastic road builders. They still exist. And it went through this city. So this was a great thoroughfare. Anytime you have a cosmopolitan area like that where people have all these various modes of travel in and out, you're going to get a big mixing of people, right? You're going to get people from various places, various backgrounds coming in the Ignatian Way. Thessalonica was not only situated on the Ignatian Way, it was the chief station on the Ignatian Way. I mentioned already, it was the most populous city in all of Macedonia when Paul got there, and it still is. You guys remember the Macedonian call, right? You remember Paul is over there in what is, they call it Asia. We call it Asia Minor or Turkey. He's in that part of the world, and he gets this vision, the Macedonian call. Well, this was the biggest city in Macedonia. Here he is going to answer the call that he has received. As I said, it's still a huge city, not just from population, but it's also one of the major trafficking centers in that part of the world still today. Now, with that, with the waterway, the port, the military, the roads, it's not hard for us to figure out this was a very prosperous place. A lot of commerce being transacted, and that attracted rich Romans. Some of them military people who were going to retire, right? They would go to a place like this. It also attracted a lot of Jews. Now, you'll recall the Jews had been dispersed at various times. And if we fast forward a little from those times of dispersion to Acts chapter 2, you had people coming from all over this part of the world back to Jerusalem. Well, a lot of those who had been dispersed, people who were Jews among in the Jewish diaspora, these people, a lot of them, settled in Thessalonica because it was so rich commercially. And so Jewish business people in particular were happy to be there. So a big Jewish population. Cultural diversity, we mentioned that, and strong Jewish population. Here's something interesting about the politics. A lot of different political systems, you know, but the Romans, they had an emperor, obviously. And even before they had the emperor, they had the Senate. And they would set up these regional governors. Now, we know something about that from reading about the account of Jesus in his lifetime. You know, we read about Herod and all the Herods that came after him. So we kind of appreciate the fact that there were these regional rulers. Well, then you had sort of, you had these local political kinds of rulers as well. Well, in this city, it's interesting. They had been granted freedom because when during the Roman civil wars, they chose the right side. They were friends with Caesar and those who came after him, Mark Antony and Octavian and so forth. So when that side prevailed, they were granted their freedom. So they had a lot of political freedom, a lot of liberty maybe that other cities didn't have that freed them from some of the oversight and the concerns that some other cities may have had. When Paul gets there, the city was ruled by a council of seven people called politarchs. Politarchs. This is the kind of thing I mean. Like when you know that, then when you read Acts 17, it helps you when the Bible says that Paul, well, not Paul because they couldn't get a hold of him, but Jason was taken to the rulers of the city. Who are those guys? Well, you just wouldn't have any idea unless you know that the rulers of this city at that time were these politarchs, right? And these guys had a lot more freedom than some other cities within the Roman Empire because of their relationship with the powers that prevailed. What kind of city was this? Well, what kind of city would you imagine it was? Big cosmopolitan city like that. No offense meant, but seamen coming in. You know, there's a reputation that comes along with seamen coming into port in certain places. There's certain kinds of things that stereotypically go along with that. City with a lot of affluence, a lot of money, without God. What do you think? What kind of place do you think this was? It was a wicked, godless place. And that's where Paul went, of course. They did not specialize in moral restraint. Why would they? They didn't know God. They had lives somewhat of leisure. So they didn't, all of them, you know, a lot of these people were rich, including the women. They didn't have to exhaust themselves providing for their basic needs. And so partying and things like that were very common. They were known for it. In particular, I want to point out this one God. I want to point this one out in particular because there's a couple things that I think when you realize the prominence of this one, it'll help you to digest some of what you run into. The worship of Dionysus, also called Bacchus. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of Bacchanalian feasts, but early Christians were sometimes confused with those who engaged in Bacchanalian feasts. A Bacchanalian feast was one that was characterized by drunken debauchery, orgies and so forth. The kinds of things that would scandalize even a godless person. That's our guy here, Bacchus. He's the god of wine, the god of festivity, drunkenness and fun. And the cult that worshiped him was symbolized by the male sex organ. So that tells you something about what was going on, that this guy was prominent in this place. Not this place only, but in this one in particular. Obviously, I wasn't going to show you a symbol of this one. It's okay. It's all right. I wasn't going to show you that one. But you take a look at what we have here. This was a typical statue of this guy. He's got a cluster of grapes here. And this is a container filled with wine spilling over. And if I made it more close up, you could see that his features are somewhat androgynous. He's a male, but looks kind of effeminate. And if you look here in the chest area, you can see that this is not the way that these guys normally would carve like a masculine man. This tells you a little something about the kinds of sexual things that this guy would have been associated with, this particular god. Now, this, of course, is not the only god that would have been prominent in this place. Not the only one. There were a number, some of the ones that would be more familiar to us, Zeus and Apollos and Artemis, Diana. They were prominent among the Gentiles in this area. Dionysus would have been right there at the top of the list. Now, why do we do that? I want us to make sure we have some appreciation when we open up and begin to read where we are in the world, what kinds of people we're dealing with here, and I think we can make more sense of what we read when we have a little background. Does that make any sense to you? It's not rhetorical. I don't know. They're still not tracking with me, Dean. It's not rhetorical. It's not rhetorical. All right, quick review. What are some of the prominent features of the city of Thessalonica? What are some things that stand out to you about this city? Very diverse, culturally diverse. What else? By the way, you see that when you read in the New Testament, you see the diversity. It's right there. They make allusion to it. What else? Strong military presence. A lot of Roman soldiers in this area. Major trade center. So there's affluence here. You know, Paul comes in, he may have been one of many that came in that day when he traveled down the Ignatian Way and went into that city. It would have been nothing unusual for strangers to come in like that. What else? Anything else? What else? Okay. Right. So we've got this religious milieu, which was common in the Roman Empire, right? When the Romans would subsume a peoples, they would tolerate a lot of religious diversity as long as people agreed to worship the emperor. As long as they participated in cult worship of the emperor, then there was a lot of freedom to do. There were gods everywhere. Of course, we know that when Paul goes to Athens, he makes that observation, right? You guys are just a little too religious, you know. What else? All right, well, let's do this then. Here's what I want to do. Let's read together in Acts 17. Next week, I want us to really parse apart and deal with the establishment of this church. But I want to read together and note any observations that sort of jump out to us, things that maybe we have a little more appreciation of because of the history here. So we read about the establishment of this church in Acts 17. I guess I'll read because I have the microphone. Usually I'd assign that to somebody else, but I have the microphone, so we'll try it that way. In Acts 17 and 1, the church of the Thessalonians. Now when they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where was a synagogue of the Jews. And Paul, as his manner was, went in unto them, and three Sabbath days reasoned with them out of the Scriptures, opening and alleging that Christ must needs have suffered and risen again from the dead, and that this Jesus, whom I preach unto you, is Christ. And some of them believed and consorted with Paul and Silas. Listen to it. And of the devout Greeks, a great multitude, and of the chief women, not a few. But the Jews, which believed not, moved with envy, took unto them certain lewd fellows of the baser sort, and gathered a company, and set all the city on an uproar, and assaulted the house of Jason, and sought to bring them out to the people. And when they found them not, they drew Jason and certain brethren unto the rulers of the city, crying, "These that have turned the world upside down are come hither also, whom Jason has received, and these all do contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, one Jesus." And they troubled the people and the rulers of the city when they heard these things. And when they had taken security of Jason and of the other, they let them go. And the brethren immediately sent away Paul and Silas by night unto Berea, who coming thither went into the synagogue of the Jews. These were more noble than those in Thessalonica, in that they received the word with all readiness of mind and searched the Scriptures daily whether those things were so. Therefore many of them believed, also of honorable women, which were Greeks, and of men, not a few. But when the Jews of Thessalonica had knowledge that the word of God was preached of Paul at Berea, they came thither also and stirred up the people. And then immediately the brethren sent away Paul to go, as it were, to the sea, but Silas and Timothy abode there still. Anything stand out to you as you read that? A lot stands out to me. I look at what's happening here. Where's Paul coming from, by the way? He's coming from Philippi, right? And so if we go back to look at our map, I think this one is easier for you guys to see. So he, you know, he sets sail and lands here, travels the Ignatian Way, and he gets here. And he leaves here and he goes to Berea. So you can see these places are not so very far apart, but they're very different kinds of places. Right? You guys are familiar, I know, Acts 17 and 11. You hear that all the time. These were more noble in Berea than those in Thessalonica. Well, these are two very different kinds of places, right? If you compare a city, you know, not unlike Montgomery, and I know this is, I'm stretching this to make a point here, but if you compare a city not unlike Montgomery to a city not unlike Los Angeles, does it trouble your mind? I mean, it's not hard for you to figure that people who are a little bit more relaxed, people who aren't, you know, everything isn't Hollywood, everything isn't show business, that they might be more receptive to the Word of God. See, two very different kinds of places. I just explained to you, we just looked at Thessalonica. That wasn't Berea. You know, Berea is kind of almost a suburb compared to Thessalonica. There was a synagogue of the Jews. Well, I told you the Jews were attracted to that area. Was there a synagogue at Philippi? Very different kind of place. When Paul gets to Philippi, where does he go to pray? He goes out to the water to pray. And who does he find there praying? He finds Lydia. He finds women there praying. See, in order for there to be a synagogue, I believe the number was 10. You had to have at least 10 Jewish males to have a synagogue. So you can see the difference in the Jewish population between a place like Philippi and a place like Thessalonica. And we can have some appreciation as to why, because of the affluence and the business and everything that was going on in this city. He goes into the synagogue here and he reasons with them for 3 days, or three Sabbath days, converts some people there. But in addition to the Jews, who else is he converting? He's converting a lot of Greeks, because this is the indigenous population, a lot of Greeks, and a lot of chief women, women who were well off, you know, women who were prominent, women who were important. Of course, he goes and preaches to them, and trouble erupted. And that's what I want us to, that's what we'll think about next week, some of the trouble that did erupt. But when you think about the kind of city this was, the kind of trouble that erupted maybe isn't so surprising. Right? Certain lewd fellows of the baser sort. Maybe it's not so surprising. All right, questions or thoughts for me? I think I'm supposed to stop at 7:10. I've got 7:08, so questions or thoughts for me? Yeah, well, it's right. Cowardly men, the Jews, stirred up these rabble-rousers, right? The Jews didn't go and do some of these things themselves, but I don't know, when you want to cause trouble sometimes, it's not that hard to find some lewd fellows of the baser sort who are looking forward to getting in the middle of it. And they found these guys, maybe not that hard in a place like this. Other thoughts? Questions? Concerns?
Do what he did, you know. He didn't have a lot of resources like missionaries might have today. Just a lot of faith going into that culture.
Yeah.
Trying to do what he did.
A lot of faith. Of course, we know Paul was a man of great faith. He got that call. We'll think about that next week. You know, he's on his missionary journey, and he had one plan in his mind, and God showed him a different one. He follows God's plan, of course, and did great work because he did that. Well, here's what I'm going to ask you to do. I would like you to read, well, there it is, read, we previewed it. I want you to read Acts 17, 1 to 13. I want you to, next week when we sit down together and begin to discuss it, I want you to be intimately familiar with the information that we have regarding the founding of this congregation. So, you know, it's not a lot of verses. I'm asking you not to read it just one time. I don't think it'd be too heavy a lift to read it once a day, 13 verses once a day. And this is going to be our emphasis in the next class. Thank you.